army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 72 of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. Title of this episode will be Modern Antifa Communist Insurgency in the U.S., Part 1. So, a little bit of housekeeping is in order. As all of you know, some health scares have occurred in my life in the past month plus. Everything is good. I am alive and vertical. It appears that I have the heart of a thoroughbred. Everything appears to be good to go. There was a slight scare, but that is now past tense, and I have made some changes in exercise and diet, increasing the former and modifying the latter to make sure that maybe I can remain in this earthly realm for a considerable period of time from this point forward. I am rather ancient, now being in the middle of my seventh decade on planet Earth, blessed with a wonderful life, 3 sons, 2 daughters, 7 grandchildren, and more, hopefully counting. We are a week late on my fortnightly cadence that I try to maintain on the issuance of these podcast episodes. In addition to the health issues that I have had, we are in the middle of some big relocation things that we are undertaking here in the great state of Florida, in which we are going to leave the present bunker and relocate to an improved bunker in the wild and woolly panhandle. I wanted to do a shout out to my 49 paid subscribers that I have at my Substack for Chasing Ghost and a Regular Warfare podcast, and also War Notes, my companion podcast on conventional conflict. Thanks so much for your support. I really appreciate it. For those who aren't aware, yes, I do have a Substack. One of the primary reasons I wanted that Substack is so not only would RSS, which isn't part of Substack, you know, populate all the podcast vendors out there that my loyal audience members use to access the podcast, but I have an opportunity to engage in conversation and discussion on each of those episodes and the very occasional dispatches that I put out. I wanted to make note of the receipt procedures here at the Chasing Ghost Bunker Complex. And as you all know, I am a lifelong bibliophile. I have a very large library. I read a lot of books, have read a lot of books since my youth. I find that the primary transition means for me to gain knowledge, interrogate questions that I have, large and small, and to arrive at some of the conclusions and observations that I use in either researching history, looking at contemporary events, or even forecasting into the future. Now, many of you use Wikipedia. Wikipedia, it should be called Wikidpedia, is so thoroughly and epistemologically corrupt that you better check the hand receipts, footnotes, and references that are used in that venue, because there is an ideological component to everything that you see there. I try to make it a habit when I use Wikipedia to always go down to the references and the citations and such. And there is something that's been going on for generations in America in non-STEM and unfortunately STEM research nationwide in this vast electronic journal academic archipelago that is out there that publishes work by professors, academics, and such that it turns out has to either be retracted, I go to Retraction Watch, which I find to be a lot of fun, or it is found to be irreproducible, especially in STEM as we move forward. But as I've mentioned in the past, for those of you who are perennial listeners, Mortimer Adler, He and Clifton Fadiman were editors at the Encyclopedia Britannica and single-handedly brought the great books of the Western world, both the 64 and 60-volume editions, into the world, birthed them into the world. And those are terrific resources. Well, at one point, he talks about a comprehensivist notion, and that notion is syntopical. Like my favorite book probably in the past decade, that would be Nassim Taleb's Black Swan and his Incerto series, that would be Taleb. Well, in this case, syntopical refers to a type of syntopical reading, a method of comparative analysis where one reads multiple books on the same subject to compare, contrast, and question the different ideas presented. This advanced reading strategy, which, by the way, Mortimer Adler puts forth in his book that I also recommend, How to Read a Book, sort of like a investigative and user's toolbook for making the best of books. Now, what this does as an active reader who interrogates what you're reading, you are at a level of reading where you are paying attention to what's going on, is that it allows you to make comparative analysis. It makes it so that you are problem-oriented. It also makes it so that you have a holistic view. In other words, if you can capture the details of something and you can still harness and assign those to a larger scope of what is happening in the book, it allows you to get a systematic approach to what's going on. For instance, I always tell folks that if you're reading a nonfiction book, I will save you a lot of time with this one simple thing that I would recommend you do, which is that you read the last chapter first, and it does two things. Number one, it allows you to get the author's summation of where he's going. And number two, you start reading the book after having done that, knowing where the author is going, having an idea of his compass azimuth for his ideas that he's putting together. Now, analytical reading is hard. It's just like critical thinking. Critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. Now, I know that sounds coy and maybe even trite, but nonetheless, it works out. Inspectional reading is one of the lowest levels of reading. Analytical reading is where you're really, in a single book, taking it to task, interrogating it, being skeptical. Syntopical reading is the most advanced level where you are reading a number of books on the same subject, whatever it may be, and you start to get almost an unconscious competence. And it gets your intuition engine juices flowing so that having read three or more books on the same subject, if you were an active reader, you start to get a really good idea of both the smaller details in these epistemological, these knowledge frameworks, and also where they're going and what those conclusions would be from which one can do forecasting. Which brings us to today's topic on anti-fascist, which is a very fashionable notion today, especially on college campuses. Most of you who have listened to me for a few episodes know that I think that the college campus is the orchid house, the breeding stables, the finishing school for communist thought in the United States. Now, some of my listeners, especially those who may be a bit left of center, as skeptical as I am of using the 18th century French notions of political thought with left and right, because I think that it should be between individualist and collectivist, and I happen to be in the former camp and not in the latter camp. So I'm going to employ the word small c communist in the way that Jesse Kelly on Twitter and others have used it, as simply an overarching umbrella term, a rubric, as it were, that describes government supremacism. Government supremacism would be that creed in which human beings are collectivized, in which they are always subordinated and suborned by large statist government structures. E.O. Wilson, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Harvard entomologist, famously quipped regarding communism and socialism. Great idea, wrong species. I think that that really sums it up for me as to why I am not very fond, nor am I fond of reading into the history and discovering that in the 20th century alone, over 160 million human beings were exterminated in the name of the communist/socialist creed. There may be a bifurcation or distinction between communist and socialist. I would suggest to you that communist brandish the gun while the socialist hides the gun behind their back, but in the end, it always comes down to the gun in the hands of the state to force people to do what they wish not to do. So, as is my wont on this podcast, I always like to figure out that, you know, you never know where you are now unless you know where you've been. So, what is the origin story of this notion of Antifa? It's one thing to say that you're Antifa. It's one thing to say that you're anti-fascist, but in the end, is there a particular brand type that this is attached to? It's much like saying one is anti-terrorist, anti-American, anti-communist, whatever that happens to be. But the two flags, the black and red flags that are so appropriate to everything we see about this alleged idea, since it isn't an organization, according to the coprophile media, one would say, well, let's try to dig into the roots of this thing. Well, the roots happen to be German, and those roots happen to be the two flags that one sees waved about in all of these protests and all of these actions across the fruited plain, that black flag, which has a red flag in front of it and says anti-fascist action, just so happens to be anti-fascistische action in German from the 1930s. Where did this come from? Well, you can thank Joseph Stalin for this particular origin story. It is a political movement in Germany, and it has been for a while. As a matter of fact, it was set up by the then Stalinist Communist Party of Germany, KPD, during the late history of the Weimar Republic, before 1932, after the forced dissolution in the wake of the Machtergreifung in 1933, the movement went underground. In the post-war era, anti-fascistische action inspired a variety of different movements, groups, and individuals in Germany, as well as other countries, which widely adopted variants of the aesthetics and some of its tactics. That flag then was the 1933 paramilitary wing of the Communist Party of Germany. And, for instance, from 2017 until present, one can see that that flag, and it's reversed in its orientation, by the way, which is very interesting, nonetheless is identical, because now instead of being called anti-fascistische action, it is called anti-fascist action. And this is directly related to the Stalin-funded Comintern from the 1930s in Germany, in which the flag was flown as a means of opposing Hitler and Hitler's Germany and the National Socialist. But an interesting wrinkle comes in here, and that would be that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in August, September 1939, which established a non-aggression treaty between Germany and Russia from August, September 1939 until the baleful events of Operation Barbarossa and the German invasion of Russia in June 1941, in which the expiry date had come on board for said non-aggression pact in a treaty of Axis advancement. It means that for approximately 22 months, the National Socialist and the Communist were arm in arm moving forward into the future of history in conquering, with their respective government supremacist political frameworks, what would then be the world, which of course would lead to World War II. That red flag that you see comes from the Die Rote Fahne, the red flag, which was a party newspaper of that Communist Party of Germany in 1932. It functioned as an integral part of the KPD during its entire existence from 1932 to 1933, a member of the Communist International, the KPD, under the leadership of Ernst Tolleman, was loyal to the Soviet government headed by Joseph Stalin to the extent that the party had been directly controlled and funded by the Soviet leadership in Moscow since 1928. The KPD described Antifastische Action as a red united front under the leadership of the only anti-fascist party, the KPD. Those would be communists. The KPD had proclaimed that it was the only anti-fascist party during the elections of 1930. Unlike the situation in Italy, no party regarded itself as fascist in Weimar-era Germany. Central to anti-fascist action was the use of the epithet fascist. According to Norman Davies, the concept of anti-fascism as used by the KPD originated as an ideological construct of the Soviet Union. I repeat, originated as an ideological construct of the Soviet Union, where the epithets fascist and fascism were primarily and widely used to describe capitalist society in general and virtually any anti-Soviet or anti-Stalinist activity or opinion. This usage was also adopted by communist parties affiliated with the Communist International, such as the KPD. So I'd like you to keep this in mind, because if you ask folks what fascism is, what you find now is that there are a variety of definitions available. Please don't pay attention to the dictionary or listen to folks who describe it as something that it clearly is not. Fascism, in the Austrian School of Economics, is the vertical and horizontal use of taxation, regulations, and other mandatory control regimes to impose upon firms, corporations, small and large, their obedience to the direction given them by the central state. As much as it pains certain members of the American and Western left today, fascism is very akin to socialism, as national socialism, of course, with socialism in the name, and you will get the usual suspects out there who will insist that Nazis' national socialism is not a species of the left, but a species of the right, and going on to the storm and temper of authoritarianism. Here's my take. I have an umbrella rubric for this. That umbrella rubric is government supremacism, under which one will find communism, socialism, liberalism, leftism, even neoconservatism, which is a Trotskyist-inspired ideology that tried to find its way into the conservative movement in the United States in the second half of the 20th century to provide a very substantial intellectual and emotional means to suborn the principles of limited government and limiting the power of the state in order to create a welfare state that would complement the warfare state for war overseas. Now, I just laid out the foundational properties in the 1930s. We could go back farther. As a matter of fact, we can go all the way back to the 18th century to what happened with the French Revolution, but we are not going to do that in the service of the brevity of time available to me for the episode. But I just wanted to illustrate to you that we start our baseline for this particular examination of the origins of Antifa in the 1930s. Now, we can fast forward, thanks to Heinrich August Winkler, Germany, The Long Road West, Volume 2, 1933 to 1990. He has an interesting quote. Quote, opposition to the U.S. war in Southeast Asia united student protest movements from Berkeley to Paris to Berlin. Another thing they had in common was the anti-authoritarian rebellion against the lifestyle of an older generation, against professors' control of universities, against the establishment, and what only seemed to be its tolerance, but what was in reality repressive tolerance. There were additional grounds for protest in West Germany. The most important was a repression of the past and what seemed to be its cause, the continuity of the societal relations of power defined as a restoration. Another factor was a virtual disappearance of a parliamentary opposition from the left after the formation of the Grand Coalition in late 1966. The student movement and its hardcore, the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, a communist front group in the 1960s, seized the opportunity to represent itself as an extra-parliamentary opposition, and to level the same charges against the SPD that the extreme left had used repeatedly against it ever since 1914, treason against its principles. End of quote. So I'm showing that to you to show you that over a generation after World War II in the 1960s, all of a sudden America and the West is finding its footing in its own neo-imperialist longings. And in this case, they visit them upon Vietnam and the appropriate anti-authoritarian forces start to come out. But what one finds in Vietnam, for instance, and I've covered this in the past, I would point you to my episode on My Lai, is that not only were they opposed to the war in Vietnam, they were in favor of the communist takeover in Vietnam. This whole notion of communism having a virtue on and upon itself as a narrative framework for advancing humanity is not lost on any of us. Not only did it start in the 1930s, one can arguably say that it probably started towards the beginning of the 20th century, and that once the Germans delivered that bullet train with Vladimir Lenin and his colleagues and associates into the body politic of Tsarist Russia to end in the murder of the entire royal family by the Bolsheviks and the creation of what was arguably the first modern communist state, to be followed by others in China, Cuba, and all around the world. As a matter of fact, leading to World War II, and after World War II, communist expansion continued almost unabated. You will note that in Hollywood, rarely does a movie come out that is critical of communism. Although there are legions, hundreds of films, critical, arguably justifiably so, on National Socialist Germany as the be-all and end-all of all evil. I am not here to apologize for them or to say that they were better or worse. I am here to tell you that the identitarian totalitarians that were the National Socialist uniquely in 1930s and 1940s Germany are patient zero for the woke mind virus that has been attacking the American university system, intellectual system, coprophile media system, and all the rest since the 1960s. If there is any inheritance that the West has from Hitler and National Socialism, it would be the woke 21st century variant of National Socialism, with the identitarian insistence on one's DNA, pigmentation, groin tackle, and all of the identifying markers that makes you a vertical and ambulatory human being as possibly solely the only marker of your humanity. So using Occam's razor, my recommendation, my suggestion of how to observe this is, moving forward, the government supremacist rubric under which one finds National Socialism, Socialism, Communism, these are all kissing cousins. But what we're really concerned about here is not choosing what poison to embrace by saying, well, on one side, there's the Nazis on the other, there's the socialist on the other, there's the communist. What I'm recommending is that what makes it so much easier, again, a nod to Occam's razor, just assume that they all have a almost childlike reverence for the power of the state in collectivism to send humanity in the direction in which the nomenclatura and these so wise intellectuals know how to steer you in the right direction, since your individual autonomy and moral agency is not relevant in the way they see the way the world works. So if it troubles you that I characterize modern Antifa in the 21st century as communist, then just substitute in your head the word National Socialist, Socialist, Leftist, Liberal, whatever you may find comforting to the way you apprehend the world. But nonetheless, here's what we know for a fact. Antifa is wedded to the idea of ultimate and unlimited collectivism, is wedded to the idea that the state is the only arbiter, big government, Leviathan government, gigantic government, all-consuming government, is the only solution to all the world's ills. So if it troubles you that I use the lowercase c word communist to describe everything that I view as what Antifa is about, well, there it is. Just substitute the word that makes you feel more comfortable. There was a fellow by the name of Yuri Bezmenov, who was a Soviet journalist who worked for the KGB's propaganda arm before defecting to the West in 1970. His principles are not formal doctrines, but rather a four-stage process of ideological subversion. He described in lectures and interviews throughout the 1980s. I would urge you, if you get a chance, to take a look at what he has to say. There's a lot of amusing videos. He has become something of a legend in social media and in memes by employing him to make light and make fun of government supremacist apologists who live around us today. The four stages of ideological subversion are the following. Number one is demoralization. In this phase, lasting 15 to 20 years, the moral and ethical foundation of a society is systematically eroded. The goal is to influence the minds of young people by infiltrating educational institutions, media, and cultural platforms with propaganda. Please note that when I say infiltrating educational institutions, that is K through PhD. Remember that one of my notions is that the federal subsidy of K through PhD, of kindergarten through PhD, and everything in between, from the elementary schools to the middle schools to the high schools to the colleges and the universities in America, this has been the Orchid House. This has been the formative ground in which the very notions of government supremacism have found their way to the top of the hill as the dominating philosophy of all the chattering classes, the intellectual classes, and the coprophile media. This creates a sense of disillusionment and a rejection of traditional values. It makes the population unable to assess true information in this demoralization phase. Second phase is destabilization. This shorter phase, lasting 2 to 5 years, involves attacking a country's core institutions. Bezmenov claimed that the KGB targeted a nation's economy, foreign relations, and defense systems to compromise its ability to counter internal and external threats. During this period, the subverted society experiences increasing social unrest, economic instability, and political polarization. By the way, when Bezmenov talks about the demoralization phase lasting 15 to 20 years, the destabilization lasting 2 to 5 years, I put no credence whatsoever in those numbers. But I do think that over generations that these things have instantiated themselves in our society as we look around in the West. Third stage is crisis. This phase is characterized by social chaos, heightened tensions, and a breakdown of trust and authority. Bezmenov said this period, which he claimed could take as little as 6 weeks, was intended to push a society to a breaking point. Now, there's two things that I want to point out here when it comes to crisis. Number one is Brian Burrow did a book called Days of Rage, which I recommend you read. We see bombing, violence, assassinations occurring today, but they're certainly not occurring with the frequency that they did in the 1960s and the 1970s. I have said in previous podcasts that if one pays attention to what happened in the very late 60s, in the early 1970s, bombings, killings, political murders, those kind of things were everyday, if not every week, occurrences across America at the time. There's nothing new here. Number four is what he claims is normalization in the final stage. The new foreign-controlled social order is established. Bezmenov used the term normalization, ironically referencing the Soviet justification for crushing the Prague Spring in 1968. In this stage, a new reality based on the subverter's ideology becomes a new normal, and the population no longer resists the changes. What's interesting about this, too, is that I just mentioned about that violence that was so prevalent during the early 70s in America, and that would continue, of course, through the entirety of the 20th century with the bombing of congressional offices in the 1980s, subversion that would take place elsewhere. But also, what Bezmenov is describing here is also color revolution. Color revolution are the hybrid and gray zone warfare that is conducted in cyberspace with voting machines, with voter tampering, with the coprophile media or mainstream media prognostications that are being squawked out by the usual outlets trying to steer public opinion and things like that. When you look at America's formal color revolution startups in the Philippines in the 1980s, all the way through all the color revolutions, to include the ones in Ukraine in 2008 and 2014, that were sponsored by the United States government and the West to shift and pry from power pro-Russian forces to make them pro-NATO forces, a lot of this seems to be very relevant today. And I do think that there is a reemergence when it comes to Bezmenov's factors. But the one that I really don't put a lot of credence to is where he said that this was used as a means by the then NKVD and then the KGB to influence through foreign influence in other countries to put them under the foreign rule of other countries short of war. I don't think that's quite the case today. I do not think that the Chinese, the Russians, or any active foreign power is trying to suborn the United States to take over said government in either a civil war or a color revolution. I think what's happened here is a homegrown and entirely organic communist domestic insurgency. We can put the label of Antifa. As a matter of fact, there are probably other labels out there. There are probably other affiliates, other organizations, much like the communist and socialist and government supremacist food fights that we saw in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, in which it was quite literally a Monty Python skit in which you had the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front in glorious intersectional cannibalism mauling each other over who would be the one that would represent. These kind of ideological food fights, of course, are one thing that folks like Franco and other historical figures who were fighting communism in the 20th century and well into the 21st century would subtly or not so subtly exploit in trying to drain their influence and power from the country. Antifa and its affiliate organizations are a domestic communist insurgency, however you want to characterize that. This is one reason why the present administration has declared war on them by naming it as both a domestic and an international terrorist organization. Now, those designations are significant, and the distinction, the bifurcation between those two designations is important. It's one thing for one to be labeled a domestic terrorist organization, but by being an international terrorist organization, it unleashes certain forces when it comes to the examination, especially forensically, in putting all the baselines together on where the funding comes from, who the fighters are, who the triggermen are, who the bomb makers are, who the financial instruments and instrumenters are that are providing for the auxiliaries, the safe houses, the funding, the legal representation, like the National Lawyers Guild, which has been a communist-affiliated organization since its origination in the 1930s. On December 1st, 1936, nearly 25 East Coast lawyers met at the City Club of New York to discuss creation of a new group counter to the Conservative American Bar Association. Conservative, well, that's changed. After that, the National Lawyers Guild was founded in Washington, D.C. at a convention held from February 19th to the 22nd. In 1937, as a matter of fact, they received a letter of support from no other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Quote, I am sure that the results of this meeting will be worthwhile. It is time for progressive and constructive thinking. And having known most of you intimately for many years, I have every confidence that your deliberations will affect the welfare of your own profession and the well-being of the country at large. I send to you my hearty felicitations and warm personal regards. End of quote. This would be the same FDR awful office that would be absolutely infested and penetrated by Soviet NKVD and KGB provocateurs, infiltrators, and spies, to include Harry Dexter White and Harry Hopkins, both very influential friends of FDR who turned out to be Soviet codenamed KGB officers. As a matter of fact, according to historian Harvey Kleher, K-L-E-H-R, one of my favorite historians of the American communist movement since the 1930s, the NLG was allied with the Communist Party. In the 1930s, a significant number of NLG founders had been members or fellow travelers of the Communist Party USA, including Reimer and Joseph Brodsky of the CP's International Labor Defense Auxiliary. During the McCarthy era, the NLG, the National Lawyers Guild, was accused by Attorney General Herbert Brownell Jr., as well as the House Un-American Activities Committee, of being a communist front organization. The 1944 House Un-American Affairs Committee, it didn't start with Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s, asserted that the NLG was merely a streamlined edition of the International Juridical Organization, a Communist Party mass organization established in 1931. The document charged that the National Lawyers Guild had faithfully followed the line of Communist Party on numerous issues and has proven itself an important bulwark in defense of that party, its members, and organizations under its control. Particularly damning in HUAC's eyes were the NLG's reversal of position on the War of Europe after the June 22, 1941 invasion, and we just talked about that with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where all of a sudden, up until June 1941, communists planet-wide were allied with the Nazis, but once Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of Russia, commenced, they did a 180-degree turn and condemned Nazi Germany. As a matter of fact, they offered, quote, unlimited support to all measures necessary to the defeat of Hitlerism, end of quote, in supporting the Roosevelt administration's policy of all-out aid and collaboration with Great Britain, the Soviet Union, China, and other nations resisting fascist aggression. I think that there are untold treasures to be dug out of the proceedings of the House Un-American Affairs Committee when it comes to all of this stuff. If we're trying to search out, dig up, and discover forensically what are the roots of the present communist domestic insurgency that we have in the United States. Just so you know, as background, Senator McCarthy in the 1950s was demonized for trying to root out and expose communist activity in the United States. Mind you, some of his techniques may have been coarse and wrong-headed, but nonetheless, it turns out to be true. And I want all of you to know who are listening right now, that was the 1950s with Senator McCarthy. The House Committee on Un-American Activities, HCUA, popularly known as the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was an investigative committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, created in 1938 to investigate alleged disloyalty and subversive activities on the part of private citizens and those suspected of having communist ties. I repeat to you, 1938. It became a standing permanent committee in 1946, and from 1969 onwards as the House Committee on Internal Security. When the House abolished the committee in 1975, its functions were transferred to the House Judiciary Committee. This is a recent discovery of mine where I just had this notion, because I had not investigated it thoroughly enough, that there was this small snapshot in American history in the 1950s in which it's McCarthy who starts this and it's McCarthy who's behind it, and that none of this would have happened otherwise. Well, that turns out not to be true. Now, it just so happens that for some enterprising historian who's looking after the primary source documentation of this House Un-American Activities Committee records from 1945 to 1975, that collection just so happens to be at the University of California, and it is described as transcripts from the investigative committee during that entire time, and the extent of it is 22.5 linear feet with 20 boxes. I wonder, and maybe some of my listeners can let me know if somebody has already done this forensic investigation, what is in there? Has anybody read all of this? Has anybody put together a history of just what they discovered in this particular collection. In addition, at the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, they have a bunch of these records that are available for public review. The Library of Congress holds a specialized collection transferred from the House Un-American Affairs Committee in 1982. I think they even have a pamphlet collection of approximately 4,000 items covering labor, communism, fascism, and other topics with a particular focus on the American left. I mentioned to you the University of California at LA, and I think even USC has some records. And I love it, too, where the records always say alleged disloyalty and subversive activities. If one were to do a search on this, you would find at the California Digital Library, you may be able to find either help or some of the original primary and secondary source documentation for this very thing. For the enterprising investigator, author, researcher, Andy Nguyen, I'm looking at you. I would love to see you investigate this or maybe find somebody on your staff or interested parties who are affiliated tangentially with what you do and your very comprehensive coverage of Antifa and communist subversion in the United States. I think there's a big opportunity for you to find out the origin story of a lot of this stuff. I'd mentioned earlier about Harvey Clare. He, K-L-E-H-R, he and some of his colleagues have written a number of books that are detailing, that were detailing, the origins of communism in America in the 1920s and 1930s, the influence that it had both sub rosa and out in the open on how America conducted itself, either by government or culturally. So there's plenty of stuff. There's something called the Venona transcripts that I would give a nod to, which are transcripts after World War II that were recordings of Soviet and communist subversion in the United States at the time, which during the conduct of the war, since at the time the Stalinist communists were allies, in air quotes, of the United States in the prosecution of that war, had been so thoroughly penetrating, influencing, and setting down the preparatory fires, as it were, for spreading communism globally, that the Venona transcripts reveal that it was a far larger operation than anybody was aware of during the conduct of the war itself. So I urge anybody interested, if you want to maybe even start an academic or authorial career, is that even a word, into really making your bones in what I would consider a historical backwater that has not been plumbed enough. For instance, in that standing committee from 1945 to 1975 at HUHOC, it became a standing permanent committee on January 3rd, 1945. Democrat Representative Edward J. Hart of New Jersey became the committee's first chairman. Under the mandate of Public Law 600 passed by the 79th Congress, the Committee of Nine Representatives investigated suspected threats of subversion or propaganda that attacked, quote, the form of government as guaranteed by our Constitution, end of quote. It was a significant step for HUAC was its investigation of the charges of espionage against Alger Hiss in 1948. None of this would have happened without the formation of the HUAC, and none of the emerging allegations that became concrete substantiation of communist subversion in the United States. Hiss started a tremendous stink by accusing Whitaker Chambers on August 3, 1948, of being a Soviet spy. The drama continued. Hiss challenged Chambers to repeat his charges outside a congressional committee, which Chambers did. Hiss then sued for libel, leading Chambers to produce copies of State Department documents, which he claimed Hiss had given him in 1938. Hiss denied this before a grand jury, was indicted for perjury, and subsequently convicted and imprisoned. The present-day House of Representatives website on HUAC states, but in the 1990s, Soviet archives conclusively revealed that Hiss had been a spy on the Kremlin's payroll. You have to be very careful when you're examining this, because there's some sleight of hand and desinformatia maskarovka going on here. Nonetheless, it remains inconclusive to this day because of a very powerful anti-communist strain that instantiates itself through the modern academy. I happen to think that America owes it to itself to reinvigorate a House Un-American Affairs Committee and see where the evidence leads forensically, historically, and contemporaneously. So what we're going to examine in what has to be a multi-part series is, where did Antifa and the communist domestic insurgency come from? What are they doing presently? How has the American government, for instance, through the U.S. Agency for International Development and other means of providing monies to protest groups, Antifa networks, things like that? The Government Accountability Institute revealed recently that the radical left groups tied to Antifa have received over $100 million in taxpayer money. Funding reportedly passed through groups like Arabella Advisors and the Tides Foundation, billionaire donors like George Soros and Hans-Jörg Wyss. The coprophile media has been a willing accomplice in this decades-long gray zone and hybrid influence and shaping operation to characterize communism as not as bad as those 160 million plus corpses would have us think ex post facto since the beginning of the 20th century. I do find it fascinating that constantly most of us on this part of the spectrum are being assailed as anti-communists, saying, oh, Antifa's just an idea and it's not an instantiation of a movement. Well, how do you send monies to an idea? As a matter of fact, the author of the Antifa Handbook and his wife, Yesenia Berrigan, that author would be Mark Bray, B-R-A-Y, he provides Antifa groups an instruction manual filled with terror tactics. Bray wrote the terrorism how-to manual after meeting with 61 Antifa leaders in 17 countries. He brought his findings back to the U.S. Yesenia Berrigan was convicted for conspiracy to distribute meth, but her sentence was commuted by President Biden in 2024. The worm turns, and they have self-exiled themselves in Spain. So it's very interesting. I would love to put to rest this very notion that Antifa is simply an idea, because one can say the same thing about, well, communism is simply an idea. But what one can do here, especially with, as I described earlier, the international designation of the terrorism group, is you can whiteboard, which means that you get analysts who have access to, let's say, cell phone records, let's say banking records and things like that, that they would get from the appropriate data vacuuming organizations, both clandestine and not clandestine. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network with the U.S. Treasury. Their mission is to safeguard the financial system from illicit activity, counter money laundering, and the financing of terrorism. They have the means to put together the investigatory and forensics baseline that will allow them to pursue and find the shooters, the bomb makers, the auxiliary networks, the shadow exchange organizations that provide for safe houses, that provide for the National Lawyers Guild, that provide for legal aid, all of these things, and put them together in a nice, neat package despite the cellular networking, which is very savvy by Antifa in creating the network that they have for themselves in order to have these miraculous idea-driven organizational protests and things that happen all over the country, and it happens all over the West in such a frequent fashion. The means are there to do this. As a matter of fact, I would suggest to you that anyone under the age of 30 who has attended college or graduated college can't stay away from their phones. And if one were to use the cell phone networking apparatus to template and discover who is associated with whom, who talks to who, you can even break down cellular organizations that by their very notions of cell organizations are trying to provide a means of stopgapping so that associations can't be made. That will not happen here because the cell phone networks will tell all. In 2013, there was a column by Lizard Farmer called How They Hunt, in which he put this entry together that was very revealing on how all of these government organizations would pursue an individual or a network and try to put individuals and networks together and what they would do. I will provide that in the show notes so that you can read it for yourself. It's rather brief, but what he describes is very interesting, especially in this day and age in the 21st century, in which we don't have people who have the discipline to simply employ couriers. We don't have people who have the discipline to use Faraday bags to guard their cellular communications or phone communications of any type or internet communications of any type. In this case, he published the column in 2013 and made it contemporaneous with the Saranovs, who were the ones who did the Boston bombing. And he was talking about how they would draw down or find in this case, a hypothetical fashion, who a group of insurgents were and how to crack open their network. And he says, quote, "These tactics are how insurgencies are broken. They're what enabled the system to pin bin Laden down, catch the Saranovs, and identify drone strike targets in the Middle East. Networks are deadly to an insurgency. Even operating in meat space can be deadly without the right precautions. All it takes is one person to use that phone to call or that debit card to pay, and they've been nailed in time and space. Sure, you may be using your regular phone and not your disposable one to call Bob, but you're there and the records show it. And if your battle buddy does something similar, he's fixed at that time and place as well. So now both of you are associated. The key is discipline. When you meet, you go completely off grid. Completely. No phone use, no debit card use, not in and around the geographical area and time frame you meet. Recon and identify how you could expose yourself. Does a certain route have license plate readers? Then don't use it. Convenience stores, they all have cameras at the counter and the pump. Nearby ATM machines, cameras and transaction records. The golden rule at all times, and I mean all times, is to ask yourself, how will what I'm doing at this second expose myself and others to identification?" End of quote. Now, what we have here is a very interesting explanatory framework on how to crack these networks. And what it also tells you is this, is that with all the intelligence organizations in the U.S. and the West, I think there's 17 or 18, I lose track of the intelligence agencies or intelligence concerns in the United States government alone, along with all 50 states' state investigative networks and their ties to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and all of their tentacled and intermingled ties, if the government could find the means to seamlessly integrate and make interoperable from the local to the county to the state to the federal level, their intelligence apparatus and their investigatory apparatus, much like when we saw the fusion centers, which have been a manifest failure for the longest time because of the ingrained loyalty and side bias problems with those officers who are actually prosecuting the fight. So here's what we know. If Antifa is simply an idea and what's in front of your lying eyes is not manifest in reality, then no one has anything to worry about because this is all an illusion. But if it turns out there is an organizational and cellular structure to what has been declared a domestic and an international terrorist organization, if the government has the metal and the merit, they do have the capability, and they have the moral will to crush this domestic communist insurgency, they can do it. So we're going to continue in other parts. In the next episode, I'm going to describe what makes Antifa a cellular guerrilla insurgency in the United States and much more than an idea. And either in that part or future parts, I'm going to offer my prognostications and forecasts of what's ahead and maybe even some recommendations for how to erase this as a threat against Americans in the U.S. and the West. Thanks for listening. This is Bill. I'm looking forward to this. I find that this is probably going to be a series as compelling as Storming America, where I talked about an upsized and upscale Islamic terror campaign in the United States. And I think that in future parts of this, I'm going to try to weave in why there may be connections between the two. So thanks for listening. You can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That's cgpodcast@pm.me. Go to my Substack, where I love to have a conversation with my listeners. There's a comment section under the Substack posting of said episode once I have it there. And gentlemanly discourse and disagreement, I welcome it all. If you wish to become part of the elite and be a paid subscriber to support my efforts here at Chasing Ghosts and War Notes, I welcome that. But if you don't, I'm grateful for your listenership, and I would love it if you would pass on to friends, family, colleagues the episodes that you find entertaining and scintillating, and also to leave reviews if you would. And narrative reviews are even better than stars, but I'll accept both gladly. So thanks again. This is Bill, out.